Birth, Volume 3, The Gathering, Chapter 1. Site R is buried deep in the green granite of Raven Rock Mountain. There are 5 multi-story buildings, 2 water treatment plants, and a sophisticated air filtration system along with food storage to accommodate up to 3,000 people for a period of more than 2 years. It was built to function as an underground pentagon for military command and control, but once it was connected to Camp David with a special tunnel 6.7 miles long, it began to serve as a secure location from which to run the U.S. government. During the first term of President Franklin D. Roosevelt, the Soviets infiltrated the White House at the highest levels. The master Soviet agent, Harry Hopkins, created and implemented dozens of new agencies, departments, bureaus, and administrations. During the next 84 years, Semyaza's blueprint for a dark and sinister second government inside the Republic grew to more than 650 agencies and took control of the country away from the legislative branch on behalf of global corporations. These agencies wrote their own laws, assessed taxes, and took police actions against violators of those laws. Sometimes they used the IRS to attack them or prevent their non-profit tax status. They often hired mercenaries to enforce their laws. Sometimes they choked a victim to death on the sidewalk in front of cameras for the world to see, for nothing more than selling cigarettes on the street for $1 apiece. Sometimes they shot resistors in the back or in the head while they were unarmed, and sometimes they would burn them alive, including women and children, live on national television. Sometimes the agency would use killer drones that shoot small missiles, and the collateral damage would kill school children, teachers, or healthcare workers. It didn't matter. Nothing ever happened to the murderers. The agencies simply wrote laws preventing the disclosure of the identity of the shooter or the firebomber. After all, it was in the name of the rule of law. These same corporations bought up all the world's media and news companies, publishers, and satellite networks, as well as unilaterally passing a body of new laws restricting the use of the Internet to approved content. The news story would be written and disseminated to the actors posing as news anchors, along with a theme song if it was necessary, and within a few hours no one in the world would care for another moment about the criminal activities of the state's agencies. Sometimes the agencies would seize millions of acres of land away from the state, burn or kill the residents living on those lands, and then sell the rights to the resources on those lands to global corporations. No one ever successfully opposed them. By the time Riker became president, the agency government owned nearly 1 billion acres of state lands, making up nearly 60% of many Western states. No matter who the people elected to office, the freedom and liberty once integral to the American experiment were replaced by a massive surveillance state accompanied by the power to sanction and prosecute any individual with evidence collected months and even years before a crime was committed. Everything a person ever did, spoke, or wrote was used against them in a court of law, even if the crime was only suspected that it might be committed. The system was capable of destroying the lives of anyone who opposed the actions of this corporate government. The casting of presidential candidates only includes those individuals who are groomed, trained, and approved by the corporate government. The committees are owned by global corporations and write their own rules so that only the people they choose can represent them at the convention. No matter who the people vote for, all of the choices are the same and yield the same progressive slavery of massive debt and lack of representation. The inexplicable election of Robert Riker changed everything. The two candidates were getting ready to do the national debate show in front of millions of viewers and with millions in corporate sponsorship. The Republican candidate accused the Democrat candidate of poor ethics, or maybe it was the other way around. No one actually paid any attention to who said what, because when the punches started flying and Secret Service agents had to step in to break it up, and they started fighting one another as they were each tasked to protect a different candidate, the American people saw enough to ruin the whole show. The bloody noses and torn $5,000 suits covered social media from thousands of cell phones, even though the network quickly broke for commercial once the brawl began in earnest. The voters turned to Robert Ryker, an independent candidate who had run his entire campaign on YouTube by answering every debate question in front of the camera as though he was standing next to the front runner on that stage. The people liked his answers. Ryker had help from the owner of the LA Times, Abdullah Bayazed, who made sure the YouTube shorts were networked everywhere, to everyone. When the election took place, tens of millions of people wrote in the name of Robert Ryker, and the first outsider was elected in nearly a century. The corporations were furious. The news media was outraged. The agency government, designed and managed by an ancient being living and operating from the Cheyenne Mountain complex, was about to recapture the leadership position when something else took place. The two planets that make up Earth began to come apart. According to ancient prophecy, an outsider president would be elected under very curious circumstances during the decoupling of the union of the polarity. An ancient order of mortals and a few immortals monitored every nation on Earth in an effort to find this anomalous leader, and they found him in Robert Ryker. They quickly brought him up to speed as to what was going to happen to planet Earth. Even more importantly, he was taught how vital it was that the consciousness of the population of mankind was integral to the division of Earth into its two primal halves, the temporal Earth and the spirit Earth. There was a small group of angels sent to Earth to watch over early mankind, but they were turned to a dark purpose by Lucifer shortly after the birth of Cain. The offspring from the seduction of Eve by Lucifer was preserved by the Creator and allowed to proliferate. Semyaza secretly led his people and captured the entire U.S. agency government in a web of bribes, subterfuge, and graft that formed the largest crime syndicate in global history. The system of alchemy designed by Semyaza was brilliantly executed, sinking the entire global community into derivative debt so deep that centuries of profits could not repay it. By the time Ryker was elected, Lucifer's seed was so powerful that it plunged 54 nations into a constant state of war and enslaved more than 400 million women. And then something phenomenal occurred. A plot to nuke Mecca and Medina failed when would-be terrorist Boris Domashev could not be convinced to detonate the bombs in hatred. That, however, did not stop the prophecy from being fulfilled, as massive plasma discharges jumped from planet to planet across the traumatized ionosphere and vaporized four cities in one night. Mecca, Medina, most of Las Vegas, and the Vatican City portion of Rome were completely destroyed. The event left the world speechless. Of course, millions of people died in an instant at each location, but the reason why prophecy would take these cities was the subject of global speculation. The grip held by the Catholic and Islamic religions for millennia on most of the world's population was broken, like slapping the sword out of a child's hand. Without a pilgrimage, billions of Muslims were blocked from ever reaching heaven. Add to that the fact that Allah apparently forgot to show up to protect the two holiest cities in Islam, and there was an immediate emancipation of nearly half a billion women. The movement could not be contained, and within 24 hours of the event, not a single burqa or hijab escaped the fires of scorned females. Thousands of imams were hung or beheaded within the same amount of time, and the people were freed after 1,400 years of slavery. The Catholic Church had been slipping for decades as a religious force, but the leverage used by the Vatican to control the leadership of nations for hundreds of years evaporated from the planet, along with every record, priest, and monk in a matter of minutes. With the leadership of Robert Riker and the presence of information provided by his unlikely team of humble heroes, the people of Earth were finally free to choose for themselves. Person by person, neighborhood by neighborhood, and state by state, the population of Earth came apart like a spiritual sieve. And quicker than anyone could imagine, it was gathering together into two populations, vibrating at different frequencies, one with the higher earth and one with the lower earth. People were not afraid of being treated like earthlings. They simply could not find a system of government that was not tyrannical. Once the leadership positions were created, Semyaza placed his soldiers there, and they immediately began practicing unrighteous dominion to make themselves wealthy and powerful, while producing nothing of value for the societies they managed. Some were good with a gun or other type of weapon system. Others were good with their speech. His creations occupied nearly every seat on Congress and the Senate. Most of them would never have been elected to their first office without foreign or laundered criminal investments funneled through the accounts of bundlers or parts of his organization acting as tributaries of money to get candidates elected. Occasionally, they are reminded how they got elected. After 85 years, the syndicate he had built was so powerful that the public servants could openly commit crimes, and law enforcers would happily pardon them with a completely straight face on live television for the world to see. It is in this environment that President Robert Riker became the de facto leader of the higher earth population, and Semyaza's corrupt puppets ruled over the lower earth. And of course, Semyaza had on his side the seat of Lucifer, billions of whom were no longer organized under the name of Islam. If it were possible, they were even more furious over the wealth enjoyed by the seed of Adam on the bounteous and green earth that was moving away into space with each passing hour. They strongly felt that their birthright was being robbed from them. Because of this feeling, they could easily be convinced to sacrifice everything to get it back, or make sure no one got it. The trillion-dollar corporations that controlled 90% of the world's money felt they had the title to all that was wealth, and they were determined that no one was going to remove that collateral from their control. They were marshaling armies, navies, and of course space-based weaponry to make sure they were not robbed of the lands and resources that backed the alchemical wealth they had accumulated. Semyaza was not so much bothered by the facts that planets were separating. He had conquered many worlds and could design assault craft to board the escaping Earth. His concern was that he could not recruit from within the higher Earth community because its frequency had changed. They could be tempted to hate themselves. They would not hate their neighbor. There was no seed of Lucifer among them, and Semyaza could not invade with enough corrupt humans to restart a global bureaucracy from scratch. That process had taken nearly 85 years on the original Earth, And it was only that quick because of the military-industrial revolution that hastened global economics and banking. Still, he would not concede defeat. There was still a way he could attack relentlessly for decades and force the higher earth to adopt hatred and a lust for revenge to match the jealous rage in the population of the lower earth. Interplanetary travel was easy to share with the military-industrial complex. War had always been a great way to capture souls on both sides. There was nothing like the process of dehumanizing the enemy to darken the soul. Even after surviving soldiers and intelligence personnel came home, they could never recover their reverence for other people or for God. Even if they could compartmentalize those experiences and that training, there was a way to sow doubt in their minds. There was always a way to make a human proud that he was humble. There was even a way to make angels express their desire for superiority. Time, however, was something Semyaza did not have. What he did have was General Wes Morlaix. He was born to a single mother who had the idea burned into her from her father that if you spare the rod, you spoil the child. She did not spoil Wes. She ruined him. When he reached his early teens, he found an opening in the emotional cage. Whether his mother had beaten him until she was tired or had a moment of inattention while drinking gin in the watchtower over Wes's life, it is of no regard. The final few connections were completed in his mind, using the broken glass and exposed flesh of his soul. At first, it was just a spark, or perhaps a tiny waste can fire. But the wall between the cave of safety and the deepest part of him and the world outside developed a hole. It was small at first, but he could find his way back there when she was sleeping, or when he was at military school, worming his way through logic problems like a very smart rat in a very complex maze. He was suddenly a savantish tactician. When he graduated from high school, the commandant of the academy recommended him to a recruiter who was happy to meet Wes on school property and discuss the opportunity to sit for the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery Exam. Some people studied for the ASVAB, trying to brush up on the math or the dimensional aspects of the one exam, the performance on which could determine whether you became an engineer or pulled a trigger for a living. Wes agreed to sit for the exam the very same day. As a high school student, one does not have much aptitude. Inexperience mixed thoroughly with zeal usually results in life being a crapshoot for a teenager. While excited about playing in the middle of a busy highway, teenage life is usually a scattered mile of bent steel and broken glass. Wes had an almost supernatural ability to guess right answers. It was not like a slot machine, finding small similarities in bits of data and clicking off the tumbling possibilities until the answer displayed itself. It was more like he could see the person sitting there, writing the question, and placing the multiple choices like cheese bits in front of long, blank hallways. He could see the tactics of the question, and he could pluck the real fruit from the vine with amazing speed and precision. When he completed the exam, the computer ranked him in the top 0.1% in the nation. The recruiter offered him a choice of fine military careers, and Wes chose the Air Force. He felt the beatings would be less there than the other arms of the forces. When he arrived at Lackland Air Force Base, they shaved his head, dropped him into fatigues, and intensely taught him how to fold T-shirts exactly 6 inches wide and to perfectly arrange a footlocker. They also gave him more tests to see if he had other propensities. Languages, comprehension, and strategies were among the tests they underwent on an almost daily basis. The whole troop went at first. After each exam, it became a smaller group. Within a few weeks, it was just him, leaving the barracks at 7 a.m., just after morning chow, and walking to the testing office. He blazed through the most complex intelligence they had to offer. The unit commander was a young major, himself a product of the officer candidate school, busting his ass to make lieutenant colonel so he could not be riffed back to a non-commissioned officer after 6 years. He never married, choosing instead to work his way up the air training command to light bird before he was 30. He was now 32 years old and had been a major for 4 years. As a matter of unofficial policy, only Air Force Academy graduates get to make the rank of colonel. But the enemy created by the politicians had ghost soldiers. There was no uniformed army. There was no Air Force. They did not have navies. There was only an ideology recruiting, arming, aiming, and shooting humans into crowds of innocent people like an exploding bullet. The best military minds were like blindfolded children, swinging at a piñata filled with medals and lifelong pension certificates. In some respects, the entire armed services organization was made of people just like the major, looking to retire at 50, with 50% of their salary for the rest of their lives, so they could afford to own that ranch in Montana or that sports bar in Miami. It was a means to an end, which frankly did not have on the critical path American victory or even national security. The most important key characteristic involved pointing the cause of any attack on American interests at the army ranked and commanded by nameless ghosts. The process involved vaguely doing one's duty, the orders for which all came from the same dark source buried in the newly refurbished halls of NORAD beneath Cheyenne Mountain. Everything was going as planned, mostly. He was waiting for something. Or perhaps the military commanders above him were waiting for something. Or someone. The candidate indicator lights and meters covered in dust, the manuals for which had not been referred to in decades, began to flicker the day Wes Morley walked into the Air Force Intelligence Office testing facility at Lackland Air Force Base and sat down to take his first exam. The military has strategists at every level, where to apply the pressure of sanctions, air power, mechanical force, intelligence, or propaganda are strategic in nature. The tactical mind is able to imagine the intent and the future actions of all the parties in a conflict, like training for a boxing match. The offensive punches and foot placements and breathing techniques are practiced until they can be relied upon to be instantly applied in exactly the right moment to achieve victory. An even more demanding skill is the lightning-fast defensive moves required to avoid or minimize damage round by round through that fight. In a generation, there may be one person who can claim the title of champion in tactical applications. The strategy may be to apply body shots, to cumulatively force the opponent to lower his guard, for instance, but the skill to get past powerful jabs and uppercuts to apply those body shots is owned by only a very few talented boxers. The discovery of Wes Morley, who could merge the strategic with the tactical in real time, with intuition and accuracy, was unique indeed. It was a treasure that was quickly recognized, promoted, and applied against an ideology of evil so terrible that it successfully instilled a residual fear in three-quarters of the free people of the planet to ever leave their homes. The tactic of terror was successful in changing the world. No one would expect pitchforks and axe handles to succeed in tearing down a solid granite castle wall. But Semyaza knew that the application of primitive weapons in unpredictable ways needed only to kill a few shoppers or churchgoers to have the desired effect. Westmoreland was able to accomplish what 1,400 years of Muslim leaders had failed to accomplish. He was able to move millions of soldiers through enemy lines without firing a single shot. He easily armed them and commanded them without high technology. He was able to apply them in virtually any country against any target without air support, without powerful mechanized units, and while using ordinary and publicly available means of communication. In some cases, terror cells were activated with simple newspaper or radio ads or only slightly coded social media posts. The army of Lucifer's seed had been ineffectual at best for more than 1,000 years until the arrival of Westmoreland. His unique tactical mind was perhaps solely responsible for striking at will anywhere and any time in the world without the least degree of high technology. He had dozens of nations searching and destroying hundreds of targets that had little or no impact on the effectiveness of his endless and headless army.